Hey, this is Cedric, your host of the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. And before we get into this awesome chat with Brandon Quittam, the author of Bitcoin is a Pioneer Species, about ecology, how utilizing more energy is going to save us, and why he's optimistic even as we go through this fourth turning, I want to tell you about this show's fantastic sponsor. You need to secure your Bitcoin from physical disaster and a single point of failure. And you can use the CipherSafe seed storage device to do that. CipherSafe's goal is to provide tangible security tools for Bitcoiners. CipherSafe focuses on securing your Bitcoin with beautiful, elegant, and practical devices. Designed, engineered, and manufactured in-house. Machined from solid stainless steel. Waterproof, fireproof, rustproof, tamper-proof, and Cedric-proof. The Cypher wheel is designed to be physically locked with a padlock and comes with a tamper evidence seal, so you can be sure of any attempts to steal your seed words. To keep your sats safe, go to CypherSafe.io and use the code MATRIX to get 10% off your order. And now let's enter the Bitcoin Matrix with Brandon Quittam for this delightful, insightful, engaging, and educational conversation.
What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Brandon Quittam is an entrepreneur, writer, speaker, and Bitcoiner. He's been writing online since 2013, and his articles have been read by over 2 million people, including some of my favorites, including Bitcoin, the Mycelium of Money, Bitcoin and the Rhythms of History, which we discussed on episode 19, The Bitcoin Mycologist on the Fourth Turning, and now his latest, Bitcoin is a Pioneer Species, published in the Bitcoin Times. Brandon Quittam, welcome back to the Bitcoin Matrix. How are you?
Hey, Sed. Thanks for having me. I really appreciated our time together, although brief, down in Miami. There's really nothing like getting together with Bitcoiners in real life. And yeah, everybody was in town that week and just such a fulfilling, enriching, exciting, motivating, just rewarding overall. Felt really good leaving Miami.
Yeah, I was going to touch on that as well. It was great to see you in Miami and the time we got to spend together. I wish we had more. It just, you know, that infinity problem there with time. And I think I was reading this tweet thread where, you know, at a certain age, let's pick 40, you've already spent about 99% of the time you could possibly spend with any other human that's not in your house or your city. So any sort of college friend or family member who's not in your city, it's really hard to sort of make up ground and get another whole 33% of new experiences together if you see each other once or twice a year. So yeah, I really treasured those moments and the conversations we got to have. I didn't note in the top of the show that you also, I think, the head of communications at Swan. So I think Swan always has a big presence. What was your, if you could touch a little bit more on the conference, like, What did it kind of mean to you? I guess was this your second conference, or I know it was your second time in Miami. But like maybe touch a little bit upon what it meant and what you kind of gleaned over the 4 or 5 days you were there.
Yeah, absolutely. So first to touch on the concept you mentioned regarding time, the famous article I think you're referencing is on waitbutwhy.com. It's Tim Urban's blog. And the blog post is called The Tail End. And in that article, the one that really struck me was that when you move out of your parents' house, let's say you're 18 years old, you already hit 90% of the time you're going to spend with your parents is already in the past. And so that really hit me hard where, yeah, okay, sometimes I'm not in the mood, a parent calls and it's inconvenient and I'm annoyed. And I've tried to reframe that and instead say, how many more times is this going to happen? And just essentially been more open to family and spending time there because of how important it is and how little there is left. And so, yeah, it's hard to intuit that math, but it's obviously true. So read that article, anyone listening. Second conference. So for me, the big takeaway in general with Bitcoin events is it's kind of a affirmation period where you say, okay, my crazy ideas, I'm not alone in these ideas. I'm surrounded by other people who I respect, who I consider intelligent, grounded, and have, you know, a good head on their shoulders. They also came to the same conclusion. And I think that's important when you're in sort of a weird subculture that may not be the majority quite yet, is to have that feeling of affirmation. At the same time, I think that conference was an example of Bitcoin breaking out of this small little subculture, right? I would say the main event, the Bitcoin Magazine event itself, was not really my speed, right? It was enormous. It was, the content was actually pretty good, but it was a little more watered down and a little more mass appeal. And I don't fault Bitcoin Magazine or the conference organizers at all. I actually think that that's the right thing to do for Bitcoin, is to have one event every year that breaks out of the ideological bubble that, let's say, the hardcore Bitcoiners might want to preserve. And if we look to the future, I think Bitcoin is, if it's going to succeed, it is going to break out of our little bubble. And that means people that we dislike, people whose ideology we dislike, are going to adopt Bitcoin, and there's nothing we can do about it. And that is a signal of success. And so I would encourage Bitcoiners to be open-minded about that, and think long and hard, is Bitcoin the thing that we think it is? Meaning, does this thing have a chance to stand the test of time? Can it survive out in the wild, right? Those type of questions. And if we answer yes to those, which I certainly do, then there's no concern with Bitcoin entering the broader world in the broader ideological space. And so I think I sort of think of it as the hardcore people's duty to sort of provide cover fire so Bitcoin can get through the door and do the behind the scenes things necessary to make it too big to fail. And I think we're sort of flirting with that line right now. What else? I also find that meeting up with other Bitcoiners, that there's some social aspect there, this deep connection. And it's probably just due to similar values, where anyone you talk to, you're automatically going to have a good conversation. You don't need to tiptoe around the bush and figure out where each other stands in the hot topics of the day, or if we're compatible politically or whatever. None of that stuff matters, because we share this underlying base value system. And I think that's probably the coolest aspect there. And I actually think, when I juxtapose that type of social interaction, how fulfilled, deeply fulfilled I feel leaving, compared to, let's say, an average social engagement in Minneapolis where I live, where the friends might be from college, or they might be from my time working after, or from various other social circles. Sometimes I leave those engagements and I actually feel more lonely than when I arrived. And I think that's probably one of the most uncomfortable feelings I've ever had, which is that you're surrounded by people you know, and you leave feeling disconnected, even though you're in a social setting. I think that's a horrible feeling. And so sometimes maybe it makes sense to skip the social engagement that you don't care about and instead read at home and feel more fulfilled. So that's my meandering thoughts on the conference. And yeah, I think if you haven't gone to a Bitcoin event, make plans for the next one. They're very, very, very special.
Yeah.
And they're not going to be like this forever. So soak it in now. And pretty soon it's not going to be cool to be a Bitcoiner. It's not going to be the same social club, or it's not going to have the same feeling, just like there's no TCPIP ers or interneters anymore. Right.
Yep. That I think is the climax and the goal, where Bitcoin doesn't have to be a part of the conversational solution, because it just is and exists, and it's providing all that for people, and they don't even know it, I think, is the best place we could be. I think I love how you summed up the whole conference. I agree with so many of your points, probably all of them. I think the connection part of it is the biggest thing that I think you really hit home on, though, in terms of what, you know, I got from the conference, connecting with other Bitcoiners. I think the content was fantastic. I do think it is less Bitcoin focused in some regards, but I think it was still great content and challenged notions, and try to broaden the tent of the circus, maybe. I also agree it won't always be like this. I think the conference will continue to grow, and Bitcoin will continue to grow, and these times to gather will be less special or less opportune for people who are getting that kind of thing out of it now. But it's interesting how you touched on time as well, because it's tough. I mean, like, I just lost my father, and thinking a lot about how I spend my time and where, you know, Because there's always, you know, you want to see a family member, but there's always maybe another person you're not seeing in that moment. And so it's not just maybe filling all your time with these great moments, but you're still choosing and still trying to figure all that out. And I think really trying to savor, you know, or be present, you know, I think is not always easy. And then you touched on, you know, sort of can Bitcoin survive in the wild? So I think that really directs our attention to your latest piece, you know, about Bitcoin as a pioneer species. And I'm kind of curious, maybe why you wrote this piece or what inspired you or kind of motivated you to write this piece.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll give you a quick thesis just so we have context, and then I'll tell you the why. So the shortest way I can summarize is that Bitcoin miners are symbiotic with energy producers. They help each other. 1 + 1 = 3. The next thing is that Bitcoin miners incentivize net new energy production. So they make the economics of investing in energy production better. So that leads to a faster ROI for anyone building energy assets. It decreases the risk of that energy asset. Essentially, the short answer is it decreases cost of capital, which would incentivize more investment into energy assets. And the third point, which is very crucial and ties into why I wrote it, is that more energy is good for humanity. I consider energy the master commodity, and all human flourishing is downstream of energy production. So as humans increase our energy production, our quality of life increases. You can look at a chart that correlates the increase in energy use is directly correlated to GDP, right? So more energy use means you can build more things, you can have more jobs, you have a higher, safer quality of life, you have more food at a lower cost, you have better hospitals, right? Literally everything comes from this. And so that's the point that I think is the most relevant outside of Bitcoin and in this point in time. And why did I write this? Because there's so much misinformation or misunderstanding, let's say, to be charitable, about energy production, energy grids, how humans relate to this. And I like to say that Bitcoin mining is everything you don't understand about energy combined with everything you don't understand about Bitcoin, right? And so this misunderstanding around energy production, okay, a lot of people misunderstand things, and we don't need a crusade around and fix everyone's misunderstandings. But with energy, it leads to poor policy. And if we get it wrong, humans die, humans suffer, humans starve. And that's bad, obviously. And so in my mind, we need to get this right, which means we need to educate people. And I like using analogies to explain complex things. And I am especially fond of biological analogies because most people, from my perspective, do not intuit finance, economics, monetary history, energy grid, production. These are complicated things. And I think more people intuit biology than that long list of things. And so I try to use that to explain things in a more of a storytelling fashion to make it stick. And a couple more points to hammer this home. I'm going to use sort of a flagrant example here, which is that if you're in a country without reliable energy, which billions of people live without reliable energy, this could mean they only have energy for part of the day, or they only have it for intermittent periods that's not consistent. And even when they do have energy, it costs 5 to 10 times more than it costs in the US. Okay, in places like that, if you have a child who is born premature, the hospital cannot have an incubator to keep that child alive because they do not have energy. So all the premature babies have to live on their own, and most will just die simply because they don't have the energy to put in the right machine. And this is sensitive to me because my wife and I are due with our first child in 3 months. And I'm glad we live in a country with consistent, reliable, widely distributed, low-cost energy. Right, that is how we have such a high quality of life, and you know, other things we mentioned there. And so I just wanted to hammer that point home. More energy is better. And the next point here is that Bitcoin mining, it incentivizes us to produce more energy, right? It makes the investment better. But it also, in a way, if you zoom out sort of philosophically, it essentially incentivizes humans to learn more about energy. It teaches us to master energy. And how does this happen? Now there is a price floor, meaning no matter where you are on Earth or even outside of Earth, near Earth, you can sell energy to the Bitcoin network 24/7, 365 at the market price, no matter what. And so that's different from our current energy markets, which is that production of energy needs to be right next to the supply. Otherwise, there's no value to the energy. In other words, energy is not fungible, or there are peaks and troughs of energy all around the world. Bitcoin totally shatters that paradigm. So now you can, if you figure out how to mine waves in the middle of nowhere in the ocean, you can turn that into money. You can launch satellites in space with solar panels on them and sell the energy to Bitcoin, or excess energy from our existing supply that's not currently being purchased by consumers. You can also sell that, right? And so more production, more efficiency, these are really good things. And long-term, I think this will lead to a dramatic increase in our ability to harness energy. And I'll probably save, we can sort of extrapolate, what does that mean if we harness more energy at a lower cost, more widely distributed? Let's talk about that later. But there's a lot of interesting speculations we can have. That's probably good for now. That's a mouthful.
There was a lot of interesting speculations in there about where we could sort of harness energy in space and sort of the oceans. That one, I think I might have thought of in terms of the waves, but space was really interesting. It's interesting how you... I like how you talk about the symbiotic nature of Bitcoin and energy. I think that's sort of misunderstood or not even looked at. So it's not misunderstood or lack of understanding. It's just not looked at, I think, by enough people. It's interesting how you say more energy is better. I want to touch on that later. I think you said energy is the master commodity and you linked it to GDP. And then you gave another example there with the premature babies, which is a very sort of one that hits home, that you can understand very clearly about why we need energy and makes a great case for why more energy is better. So let's say, I like what you talked about biology. And I thought back to sort of seventh, eighth grade, ninth grade biology class and how we all as people just understand that more intuitively, maybe because I think it's taught more honestly at school, combined with maybe it's just more an intuitive sort of science. So looking at Bitcoin through the lens of ecology, let's say a volcano erupts and destroys all the life on an island. How does life colonize a desolate environment for the first time? Would life come back on this volcano area?
Yeah, thanks for this question. Teeing it up nicely. I'm going to answer that, but one quick point here. Is like, okay, my previous essays were more around mycology, the study of fungi. Okay, this one is a little bit more broad and more like systems thinking. And that's kind of what ecology is. It's looking at the systems of our ecosystems, inputs and outputs, feedback loops. What is the bias of this complex system? If you introduce a catalyst, what type of changes do we expect to occur in the system? Okay, so that's kind of ecology in a nutshell. And I think one way to hammer this point home is a famous example in Yellowstone. So about 150 years ago, the farmers were getting pissed off because all the wolves were coming to their farms and harassing or eating their animals. So all the farmers banded together and they just killed all the wolves. And in that process, the wolf is essentially the apex predator of that ecosystem. And you just take out the predator. You know, if you think linearly, you might think, okay, no wolves mean no problem with the sheep or the herds. But it turns out that the apex predator had lots of downstream consequences, which were not immediately obvious. However, about 100 years after they got rid of the wolves, conservation biologists decided, you know what, the gray wolf is the apex predator. It plays an important role here. As we started to learn more about ecology, and then they decided to reintroduce the gray wolf into Yellowstone. Okay. Mm-hmm. And there's a famous YouTube video about this. You can just Google gray wolf Yellowstone, whatever, you'll find it. I recommend it. But what they found by reintroducing the gray wolf is that it rebalanced the elk and deer population. Wolves eat elk and deer. And so that reduced the population of elk and deer down to a more appropriate size. And what that did was it prevented the elk and deer from eating all the grass and destroying their food system. Mm-hmm. And that allowed more trees to come back to the landscape stopping the overgrazing, stabilized the riverbanks and the rivers. So erosion got better. And then, you know, the songbirds came back, the beavers came back, foxes, eagles, badgers, all everything came back to a more lush ecosystem. And the punchline here is that since the beavers came back, they literally moved the rivers, which is what beavers do. And so introducing a gray wolf moves rivers, right? It's the butterfly effect in nature, and all of biology is connected like that, including ourselves. And so that's sort of how to think about ecology. And I'm trying to apply similar principles to Bitcoin in this essay, and more specifically on the Bitcoin mining side and how that relates to energy. Okay, preamble aside, let's talk about the pioneer species. Let's talk about volcanic island. So your question was, what happens to the volcanic island when the volcano erupts and wipes out all life on the island? This is another famous example in ecology. And the short answer is that life is not destined to be gone forever. There's a unique type of species called pioneer species, and their role in ecology is to find those desolate landscapes, land there, and essentially recolonize that area and essentially bootstrap life again. And these are organisms that are really hardy, they're drought tolerant. They have some way of spreading themselves around, such as through spores. So some types of pioneer species are fungi, and their spores, which are essentially little mushroom seeds, they're lighter than air. So they can literally just float in the air and land somewhere else. Other ones have seeds that drift in the ocean, and they just drift around until they hit dry land. Other ones are spread by birds, right? So there's some process that randomly distributes seeds. And when they do find this barren rock, the right conditions, their job is to essentially convert that rock into soil. So the most famous example is a lichen, which is a symbiosis between a fungi and a plant. The fungi essentially bolts onto the rock and uses chemistry to literally digest the rock. And it essentially bolts on plants or little solar panels that convert the sun's energy and CO2 from the air into food, fats, and sugars. So the mushroom gets the minerals and the plant creates the food, and then they trade. And that eventually over time creates soil. And that soil enables more complex life to arrive, let's say a little shrub. And then that shrub continues this process of what's called ecological succession. And then over time, maybe 50 years later or maybe more, that island is totally converted into a climax community, which is essentially the peak ecosystem of that area. So where I live in Minnesota, the peak ecosystem would be an oak forest, giant oak trees that can live 100 and some years. But maybe the early community in where I live is like a birch forest. They grow really fast. They colonize the soil. Then eventually the oaks come in and they shade out the birch and they leave. Okay, so that's kind of how the process works. And the analogy is with Bitcoin miners, okay? The miners, they go and colonize energy assets that are currently not being utilized. So if there's a river in the middle of the mountains and there's no energy being produced there, you could essentially build a hydro dam and combine that with a Bitcoin miner. That Bitcoin miner makes the economics of the energy asset better. And that starts the process of producing energy. And there's usually a gap between where the energy is produced and when it's consumed. You usually have to build these really expensive high voltage transmission lines, which takes time and a lot of money to move that energy to your consumer. Alternatively, some energy assets, they're essentially building for future demand. So let's say you build a nuclear plant next to a city, but as of day one, you only have enough demand to buy half your energy, let's say. But on a 10-year, 20-year time horizon, you expect the urban environment to grow to reach the peak of your energy production, right? So there's always those mismatches. There's oversupply. And the pioneer species come in, they buy up that oversupply. And what you essentially do is you create these little oases of energy, and then cheap energy attracts industry. Okay, if you want to smelt steel, for example, or smelt aluminum, sorry, for example, that's a process which requires large amounts of cheap energy. So maybe in this example, in the remote hydro we just built, maybe there's a aluminum smelting plant that wants to co-locate there and buy up some excess energy. Then maybe you fast forward a little bit later and you got to put the employees of that smelting plant somewhere. So you build houses. And if you have people, you need restaurants. If you have restaurants, you need bars, et cetera. Now you have libraries and schools, and essentially a net new energy asset evolved same type of ecological succession until eventually that asset is fully mature and all the consumers are there nearby. And at that point, just like the pioneer species that get shaded out by the oak tree and they're forced to leave, the Bitcoin miners are also forced to leave once the end consumer is there buying up all the energy, simply because Bitcoin miners can only afford to buy low-cost energy, whereas retail consumers like you and I will pay a lot more, in which case those miners go on and find another net energy asset that's underutilized, and they maximize the profits there. So essentially, they're spreading little pockets of human flourishing wherever they go. And I like to think of Bitcoin miners as citadel seeds, right? Initially, they're not really a lot going on. It's just whatever, some computers plugged into an energy asset. But long term, those little seeds turn into these oases of human flourishing. So go plant some citadel seeds.
Yeah, you unpacked a lot there and covered a lot of ground. I like how you covered limiting factors in nature around the elk and then around all the sort of other organisms that are trying to, you know, the rabbits, the raccoons, the songbird. You also, earlier in the show, I think you kind of defined what hash horizon is, which is sort of in the Bitcoin ecosystem, miners are pioneer species uniquely capable of colonizing energy deserts anywhere within the hash horizon, which includes the North Pole, volcanoes, and even outer space and the oceans. And I like how you included the quote, large streams from little fountains flow, tall oaks from little acorns grow. And you touched on this a bit. Think of Bitcoin miners as citadel seeds. They may be unassuming now, but given enough time, a simple mining operation can transform a barren wasteland into an oasis of human flourishing. So in terms of harnessing energy, though, and looking at life through the lens of ecology, what was the oxygen revolution?
Yeah, so in the essay, I sort of looked at energy as a limiting factor for our evolutionary process. So essentially, biology cannot expand past its ability to harness energy. And that's sort of a classic ecology look at. It's like, how does an ecosystem use energy, right? You have the sun hits the plants, the plants essentially can harness energy of sunlight, and then they use that energy to grow themselves, right? And then you have animals come by and they eat those plants, which are essentially upcycling the energy that originally came from the plants. The herbivores eat the plants. And then you have the carnivores come in that eat the herbivores. Again, you're upcycling that original energy that came from the sun. And then you might have an apex predator who eats that other predator. And so that sort of pyramid is how energy is processed or utilized through an ecosystem. And the oxygen revolution is essentially one of the major turning points or breakthroughs in harnessing energy throughout our evolutionary history. It happened about 3 billion years ago, and it's essentially the first organisms learning how to harness the sun's energy to create through photosynthesis. And it's called the oxygen revolution because at the time, our atmosphere had no oxygen, or maybe a little tiny bit of oxygen. But in come the photosynthesizing plants, who are exhaling oxygen, right? And once they figured out how to do that, our atmosphere changed really quickly and it became full of oxygen. So prior to that point, all animals that we know would be unable to survive without oxygen in the air. And so that was a radical turning point. There's a few more cool breakthroughs in harnessing energy that I highlighted. One is the emergence of eukaryotes, which are just essentially a biological term for all the complex life, all the fancy stuff. And in that process, that's essentially where two cells were hanging out next to each other. And the theory is endosymbiosis. Essentially, two organisms merge. And in that process, one organism is locked inside another organism's cell. And through that complex interaction, essentially mitochondria, or the power plant of a cell, back to your eighth grade biology you mentioned, the mitochondria gets stuck inside a cell. Mitochondria is a primitive form of bacteria. And that is essentially the Cambrian explosion. So it allowed cells to create their own energy through mitochondria. And that went from simple life to this explosion of plants, animals, fungi, all the complex stuff that we love right now. And then the next one, I obviously skip a few years here, but then we have Homo sapiens, and we have a storied past with energy, right? We first had to harness fire. I guess before fire, we could only just move around ourselves or maybe make mechanical tools. Then we harness fire, which is biofuel, right? It's ancient wood, which is essentially stored solar energy inside cellulose, a sturdy store of solar sunlight, essentially what wood is. And you get to liberate all the energy stored in that wood by burning it. Then we domesticated animals. Right. So now you can plow a field with a donkey, which might be as strong as five humans or something like that. And then we had the Industrial Revolution, where we figured out how to use fossil fuels, which obviously increased our energy density, our ability to harness it, which unlocked all kinds of crazy things that we have now. And yeah, then we have nuclear and all these other forms of energy. But essentially, that's one cool way to look at evolutionary history, is these turning points of energy harnessing. And I think Bitcoin actually represents another turning point here. It's not as dramatic as before and after fire or the emergence of eukaryotes, but it is going to help us on our exponential curve of harnessing energy, right? It's a simple incentive. And one last point here, again, back to ecological principles, is that a small change can have an outsized impact. And so in complex systems, our central planner types, or our central bankers, or our central government types, they think that you can just change the policy and then all of a sudden your desired outcome will emerge. When in reality, every policy change in a complex system like civilization leads to all these unintended consequences. So you might actually cause more problems than you fix by meddling with complex systems. And so I like to think about the energy symbiosis with Bitcoin as a really small change to civilization. It pretty much just puts a new price on energy. Mm. And that alone has a cascading effect, because humans respond to our incentives and then we go act on that. And so I think I would caution us to use a little more humility when we're changing systems in our society, due to the complex nature, and it's hard to predict the outcomes. So simple changes, simple incentive shifts, and then let the emergent order that will come from that do the work for you.
Right. Yeah. I do want to read a little bit from your piece to expand on everything you just kind of covered there. Homo sapiens, around 300,000 years ago, humans went from burning wood, biomass fuel, to domesticating animals for agriculture. Then during the Industrial Revolution, we harnessed energy, dense coal, petroleum, and natural gas, hydrocarbons, enabling the steam engine. As our ability to harness energy improved, so did our tools and our quality of life. We had time for leisure. Humans specialized and commerce exploded. Each energetic advancement dramatically increased the carrying capacity of our species. Bitcoin mining is everything you don't understand about energy combined with everything you don't understand about Bitcoin. Our ability to harness energy is a prerequisite for human flourishing. Energy has enabled humans to live anywhere on Earth without dying from heat, cold, or natural disasters. It powers our hospitals, enables transportation, and provides food security. I mean, it was around this time I really wanted to get into, you know, I was going to ask you maybe like, do we need to reduce our energy consumption? It's just, that seems to be the narrative. I think you've kind of answered that in spades. I'll read one more quote from your article. GDP per capita is directly correlated to energy consumption per capita. While not a perfect comparison, this chart wouldn't change much if we replaced GDP with standard of living. If you care about making life better for all people on this earth, you should support harnessing more energy, not less. I think maybe as we talk more, if we could just kind of keep that in mind. I don't know how many more examples we need, but there's this sort of this ongoing dialogue about how each individual should reduce their consumption of specifically energy and carbon and companies like that. And then, you know, I can't help but think too about sort of a lot of the people, not people, some of the institutions that are pushing this narrative, like say the military. I mean, the US military has never come out with like a go green campaign. It would cost too much money for all military vehicles to be electric. But also, just when they blow stuff up, how much more energy are they using? And what could I possibly contribute to that equation by reducing my consumption? If, I mean, they're going to blow bombs and stuff. It just doesn't compare. And we're just actually, I feel like I'm just being asked to sacrifice, but other entities are not in that sense. And I'm not sure sacrificing does anything, but that's a different conversation. And you also kind of covered primary producers, which are mainly plants, primary consumers, which are the herbivores, secondary consumers, which are the predators. But I'd like to hit a little bit on why are there fewer animals in a desert compared to a forest, and maybe use the cacti or the cactus as an example, or how does it respond to its environment?
Yeah, definitely lots there. So I would say, first I want to touch on the carrying capacity side and what is our future relationship to energy? Because I think this is sort of the underlying battle going on right now with energy use, ESG, et cetera, is that, and it goes way back to the 1700s. Thomas Malthus is an economist. Mm-hmm. He was studying biology and he noticed that organisms will expand in their population size up to the limits of their food supply, and then they crash their population as soon as they eat all the food. And so he uses that modeling and he extrapolates that to humans and said, eventually humans are going to continue to grow unbounded until we eat all our food. And then we also crash. Right. And I think that that alone has infiltrated the ideology of Keynesians, central planners, World Economic Forum types, Bill Gates types, a lot of the intellectual elites, the Nazis also, they all were Malthusians. And so this is essentially a position that is behind all of their policy choices. And they frame it up in this cute way, like you will own nothing and be happy, the sharing economy, all these different things. Don't eat meat, right? These all stem from this neo-Malthusian perspective. And I understand the logic where they're coming from. However, I 100% fully reject every single ounce of this argument. For several reasons. First reason is they're wrong. They're just flat out wrong. Humans are tool builders. We are not elk who mindlessly graze on the grasslands. And one side point, animals actually don't overconsume and crash as often as people think. They're actually quite intelligent and they do find symbiosis with their ecosystem. But let's skip that for a second. Humans certainly don't. Because humans build tools and we use technology to increase our carrying capacity as we go. That is the fundamental point. Our carrying capacity is not fixed. It increases as we learn how to harness better tools, right? For example, 150 years ago, more than 50% of the living human's job was to create food. They farm mm-hmm, or they mm-hmm. had animal husbandry. Today, it's less than 1% of the world produces food. Okay, how is that possible? Well, we got better technology and that allows us to spend time on other things. So we literally increase the carrying capacity of our species by doing so. So that's step one. It's just poor logic. Step two, and there's endless examples to defend my position there. Step two, it's a fundamentally pessimistic view of humanity. It's essentially saying we need to degrow, we need to stop consuming energy, we need to retreat, we need to decrease our population size, et cetera. I'm not on team on pessimism. I'm an internal optimist. I would say I'm a rational optimist. But anyways, so number two is I will not take the bearish position. I'm pro-humanity. We can figure this out just like we've done so every step of the way. Step three is embedded in this ideology is that the leaders who push this are the ones who are going to drive and steer the ship. They're going to make the decisions for us. We're going to live in the pods and eat the bugs. They're going to fly around on fancy jets, going to conferences, drinking champagne and talking about saving the world. And the scary part is they believe their own bullshit here. Mm-hmm. They do think that they are the smart ones with the education and the resources to save the world from this Malthusian fear. And yeah, again, they're unelected, they're wrong, they're pessimistic. And I fundamentally reject them telling us what to do on all those grounds. So slight rant aside, but mm-hmm. to frame that up, I think that's actually the most important thing going on here. And that's why the progressive left believes their ideological green position. A lot of it is actually psychological manipulation from people pushing those ideas. And the dangerous part, which I previously mentioned, is that they believe it's true. They believe that they are the good guys here. And it's really hard to stop the people who believe that they're the good guys, the central planner types. And so we really need to be ahead of this one, and we need to build the case for more energy is good. We need to build the case for population growth, not degrowth, or at least maintaining population is fine. Any comments on that before we move on?
I would just expand on it a little bit in terms of, I don't know if they believe it to be true or they've been trained to believe it to be true. I think it doesn't matter. I do think that individuals' desire to care has been used against us in that sort of psychological operation you're talking about. Because like in one regard, like it, from the logic of like, I want to do what I can to help makes sense to me, and it makes sense to most of humanity. So when a problem is sort of laid out and you don't sort of think skeptically about it, your first notion or instinct is, well, how can I help? What can I do to be a part of the solution? And if it's framed in a way where you doing less, you acting less of your own accord and free will help others, most people can kind of buy into that framework. And I don't think it's a bad thing to buy into. I'm not selling it as a bad thing to buy into. It's, yeah, we all want to help. We want to take care of ourselves first. I think that makes sense. And then we're looking and turning to help others in our community and our family and our friends. And I think that's been used against us. That's the only way I would expand on it there. I like in terms of the other thing that you in terms of most of the population used to be not just involved in food growing or agriculture, but also just more people had to spend most of their time cooking food or just preparing food also took up a tremendous amount of time because of technology. It doesn't. And so, yeah, I'll turn it back to you. And I think you had another comment, and then I'll frame up the next question in terms of around Bitcoin mining and what do the wolves and the moose teach us about Bitcoin's difficulty adjustment?
Yeah, definitely. To put a bow on that, I think the punchline here is that there is no optimistic version of the future in which humanity does not use way more energy than it uses today. And I totally just stole that quote from an article, Bitcoin Mining and the Case for More Energy. It's a fantastic essay written by AJ Scala and Drew Armstrong. Highly recommend that. I think they penned it under some pseudonyms or something, but that's who wrote it. And it's an amazing essay. That's that. You also had a comment about desert versus forest. I think this also illustrates limiting factors or another way to look at ecology. And so, you know, the question might be, what's different between a desert and a rainforest? Okay, a rainforest gets lots of sun and lots of water. That leads to an emergence of many plants. And plants are sort of the base of the trophic hierarchy, or in other words, more plants enable more herbivores, right? More plants is more food for the herbivores. So then you can maintain a large population of herbivores. And if you have a large population of herbivores, you can also maintain a large population of predators because they're going to eat the herbivores, et cetera. And in a desert, you have lots of sun, so that's good for plants, but you do not have very much water. So you end up in a situation where there's not a lot of water. So the plants that exist, they actually evolve spines in order to defend their limited water resources. And since there's not that many plants and they're well defended, a desert can't maintain very many herbivores because there's not a lot of plants to eat. And if there's not a lot of herbivores, there's also not going to be a lot of predators, which is why a desert feels barren and uninhabited compared to a rainforest, which is just entirely loaded with life. Right. And that's that limiting factor, in this case, herbivores. Yeah.
Right. And then, but what about, well, just kind of just turning it back to Bitcoin mining. What do the wolves and the moose teach us about Bitcoin's difficulty adjustment? Kind of elaborating on sort of that dynamic.
Definitely. So I had some fun with this one. Eighth grade biology, yet again, there's an island off of Lake Superior called Isle Royale. It's a pretty large island. It has lakes and stuff on the island, and it's on North America's largest lake, Lake Superior. And interestingly, about 50 or 60 years ago, Lake Superior froze over, and that created a land bridge connecting the mainland to this island. And at that period, wolves and moose migrated to this island. Spring came, the land bridge made of ice melts, and now all of a sudden, moose and wolves are stuck on this island. Okay. And why it's a good case study is because there's pretty much just moose and wolves on the island, and birds and a few other animals, but it's essentially a perfect population ecology study where you have wolves eating moose and moose running away from the wolves, essentially. And you can look at their populations over time, and you can see at certain periods, the moose population is large, at certain periods, the wolf population is at large, but they're essentially chasing a dynamic equilibrium. Okay, that's kind of the key point here, dynamic equilibrium. And so I tried to use that framing to explain the difficulty adjustment in Bitcoin. And so I'll just try and run through it now. What happens if Bitcoin experiences a really, really fast increase in hash power? Okay, so all of a sudden, a ton of new miners come on the network and they, let's say they double the hash power. Well, there'll be about a 2-week period or less where those miners are producing tons of blocks. And then at a certain point, the difficulty readjusts, and that essentially brings the targeted block time back to 10 minutes, essentially normalizes profits for miners, right? So there's those temporary periods of dislocation, but it's always chasing equilibrium. And this is essentially the factor that allows us to essentially predict Bitcoin's supply schedule will maintain its schedule and not be broken. Right? Because Moore's law would say we'll get better computers over time. Those better computers can hash more, which will break the supply issuance. But that the difficulty adjustment essentially brings it back to balance. Okay. Same happens on the way down, right? China ban Bitcoin mining, 50% drop rate in hash rate. 6 months later, the miners moved and we sort of rebalance. And the same kind of deal is happening in the wolves and the moose. Okay, so let's look at the two populations. If the moose population explodes, that means that there's not going to be as much food left over for the moose, so there'll be more sick moose and more disease in the moose population. And what that does is it gives the wolves tons of extra food. So now there's all these easy, sick wolves to moose to eat. So the wolves population grows in response to all that extra food. And then the wolves overconsume the moose population, which then puts pressure on the wolves. And the wolves now have an issue eating because their population got really big as their food source dwindled. So now the weakest wolves are unable to catch a moose because there's not as much food, right? That's kind of like the weakest miners having to turn off when they're not profitable, right? So you can see the wolves are the miners and the moose are essentially profits. And so, yeah, you can kind of play that out in your mind a little bit, but that's the same dynamic ecosystem. And I think one more point to hammer home here is that if a wolf dies, there's no magic potions to revive the wolf. Right. So in that situation, wolf population grew, food source declines, the weakest, oldest wolves can't eat. So they're dead. And those wolves need to die in order for the rest of the wolf pack to survive. Because if the wolves kept growing, they would essentially wipe out their entire food source.
Right.
And that is the kind of a nice parallel with our existing financial system. So right now, due to cheap money or artificially cheap money, artificially low interest rates, the cost of capital is artificially held low, which allows all this extra money in the system, which finds its way into malinvestment. Right. And malinvestment leads to zombie corporations. Essentially, the only reason why they're alive is because of this cheap access to credit. And if you zoom out, they're literally destroying capital in real terms every day. But there's no mechanism in the market to clear out those destroyed companies and recycle that capital into new and more productive uses. So those zombie companies, they need to die in order to keep the cycle going. That is the creative destruction by Schumpeter. That's important. And in Bitcoin, there are no bailouts, right? Bitcoin is like the wolf. If the wolf dies, it's dead. In Bitcoin, if you risk capital and you fail, you lost your Bitcoin. And that follows the rules of nature. And that's really, really important to follow the rules of nature. And the net effect here is that under a Bitcoin system, we accept short-term price volatility, meaning if you screw up, you lose your capital. But in exchange for people recycling their capital, creative destruction, we gain long-term systemic stability. So the business cycle magnitude will be reduced. And that's generally good for growth. We don't want these volatile ups and downs. We want a more smoothed out curve. There will still be ups and downs, but as long as we don't artificially suppress those interest rates or otherwise distort the market, then we're not going to be hiding risk in the system. That's essentially what happened in 08. We just hid risk, and all of a sudden one little Jenga block comes out and the whole system breaks. And again, doesn't obey the laws of nature, and we pay the consequences when we break the laws of nature.
Right. You cannot cheat nature. You really punch that home in the piece. I'll read two pieces here from your work. Just like the moose and wolves on Isle Royale, the miner ecosystem, modulated by the difficulty adjustment, is constantly seeking equilibrium where marginal cost to mine a block equals marginal revenue. At maturity, mining Bitcoin should be a relatively boring, low margin business, similar to an energy utility today. That's kind of what the future we look forward to, when it's boring and no one even talks about it. It really should have low margin. We see this unnatural imbalance arise when central bankers bail out zombie companies. Sure, you save one company, but you put the entire economy at risk. Rather, we must let the market settle and recycle capital. Those are your words, and I can't hammer that home enough. I think more than half of the Fortune 500 are zombie companies. If we raise their interest rates, they wouldn't have the free cash flow to support the business. And I don't think that's good for us all long term. But you touched on 08, and I want to touch on this later, maybe in the show. But I think we're headed for another 08 in the sense that, and I think we might have, I'm starting to think we might have even passed through it. I'm not sure, or it's an, but what I'm really getting at here is I think they might have the ability to punt for another 10 or 12 years. And maybe we'll touch on that later, but I do want to turn to more about how energy markets are widely misunderstood. And we touched a bit about how energy is not electricity. So it's not fungible. You can't just store it, move it around and capture it. But why are energy grids forced to overproduce?
Yeah. And what are peaker plants? Good question. Yeah. Both good questions. A lot of Bitcoin energy critics might say something like Bitcoin waste energy, it consumes as much energy as Norway or whatever. And that's bad, right? Because otherwise that energy would have gone to saving babies and producing food and whatever. However, the reality is that our energy grids are inefficient, quote unquote, by design. And the reason is, you have to have energy consumers match with energy production at all times. And the tricky part is, on a spring day at noon, let's say April 15th, on noon in the Midwest, the weather is nice and very few people are heating or cooling their house. So on that day, our energy demand, let's say in the Midwest, is really low. However, January 15th, it's midwinter. Every single person in the Midwest is heating their house, every business is. And then we get home from work, 7 o'clock, we're watching TV. So everyone's just sucking all the energy. The delta between that perfect spring day with low energy demand and that January 15 day with high energy demand, it might be about 2 to 3x higher on the high energy demand day, right? So the low days are really low and the high days are really high. And what that does is it forces us to produce enough energy to satisfy the days where we need all the energy. However, the average day is way less. So what do? We're essentially forced to overproduce in order to satisfy that peak energy day. And so that essentially means that there's always going to be excess energy that we don't need that day. And what do we do with that energy? Well, today we mostly just throw it into the ground. We literally just shoot electrons into the dirt. We have to get rid of it. So we just waste it. Alternatively, Bitcoin miners could come in and buy that wasted energy. And I think that's the missing part. Most of the energy demand from the Bitcoin network is that otherwise wasted energy. And so there's no situation where Bitcoin miners are out competing, heating someone's home or supplying a hospital with energy. That just doesn't happen. And if there's a situation where both sources of demand want the energy, what we're finding is that grid operators create arrangements with Bitcoin miners where they literally just turn off the machines if someone else needs the energy, such as a home or a hospital. And so, and what we're also finding is that the grid operators are very pro-Bitcoin because they view the Bitcoin miners as a unique type of customer that plugs in really well with the equations that they run in order to be a good grid provider. And then peaker plants are essentially power plants that are turned on when you need excess energy. And that's sort of, they like buffer that increase when there's peak demand, they essentially fire them up and produce some more energy. And they're usually CO2 heavy plants, oftentimes coal or natural gas to use as peaker plants. And yeah, and so those exist again to satisfy the peak demand. And another important point related here is that if you wanna decarbonize the grid, okay, you want to reduce fossil fuels. In order to do that, some people might say you want to have more wind and solar. Okay, fine. Wind and solar produce energy, but they're not consistent. Okay, you only produce solar energy when the sun shines. You're only producing wind energy when the wind blows. Many times during the day or year, that's not the case. And so you're not producing energy. And due to the limitations of batteries, in other words, we do not have enough minerals on our planet to produce enough batteries that we need to preserve the energy. Mm. So there's no good way to store that energy when the sun shines. And so instead, renewables only produce during the day, or solar only produces during the day. And that's actually when the demand for energy is lowest. So by throwing more solar at the grid, you're actually not increasing the net amount of usable energy because the energy is produced at a time when it's not actually needed. Instead, we would want like moon energy or something like that. When it's dark out, if the moon could give us energy, that would be convenient because that's when we actually need more energy. Mm-hmm. But that's not the case. And so what Bitcoin miners do is if you want to decarbonize, number one, go nuclear. But if some reason you can't accept that, well, you're wrong. But if you can't accept that, what you also, your next step would be to, you want more Bitcoin miners because the Bitcoin miners help spread renewables. And the reason is the Bitcoin miners will buy up that excess energy that the solar panels are generating during the day, which is inevitable. And that essentially decreases the energy investment cost, again, back to the beginning, of that solar energy. So that allows us to be much more strategic with our grid. We would need to way overbuild. And anytime that overbuild, anytime there's excess energy, the Bitcoin miners will buy it. And so to all the lefties, the progressive, the greens, whatever you want to call them, who want to decarbonize, sure, yes, let's do it. But you need Bitcoin miners to do so. And I'm thankful for guys like Troy Cross who are making this abundantly clear. And I hope the progressives are more aware of this and they start to change their mind on Bitcoin, because right now I observe a lot of virtue signaling and a lot of running their mouth without actually grasping energy markets. And if you want to fix the problem, I encourage you to do the actual homework and actually fix the problem. And I think Bitcoin miners is a part of that fix.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, my first job out of college was at Consolidated Edison of New York City, the power company. And my very first day was on July 6th. Probably because maybe July 4th was a Monday, so it came in on the Wednesday. And on my very first day, we were in the middle of a heat wave. It was like 105 degrees. And they sent us home right away. And they were like, you know, we got to power the whole city. There's a heat wave. And we got to turn this building off that you're in and everything we can. So, you know, why don't you go home? And I remember I got home. My parents, why are you home so early? And I said, well, they fired me. And they didn't like my tie. But, you know, I told them, you know, it's a heat wave and they didn't want us to use the computers today. But you mentioned intermittent energy there. Maybe you could expand a little bit about what makes Bitcoin miners like a good player in sort of the intermittent energy game compared to, say, like a hospital or other type of business like a factory.
Yeah, the big thing that helps with Bitcoin miners is that they're really easy to turn off or turn on. And so you can essentially put them as little energy sponges. They can just live next to all the production of energy. And anytime there's excess, you sell it to the miners. But then if the end user demand increases, then turn off the miners, right? And that's not possible with, let's say, a aluminum smelting plant, right? To turn off the energy going there, it might take a day and it might be really expensive to start up and shut down an entire factory's manufacturing process. Same with the hospital. Okay, we hit peak demand. You can't turn off a hospital, right? That has to go on forever. And so that's why Bitcoin makes sense there. Bitcoin miners are also portable. I think that's something that people are keenly aware of, but it has unique benefits. So the Bitcoin miners go directly to the energy source rather than I want to live in my house, which might be 10 miles or 100 miles from the energy source. And then you got to build this really expensive transmission line to bring it to my house. Instead, the Bitcoin miners go wherever the energy is. And then when they're done, they pick up and they move and they go somewhere else. So they're essentially portable. And I think that's another unique aspect.
Yeah. And I think also there, a little bit before that, I think you covered whether, how wind and solar can't save us. Bitcoin draws a lot from surplus energy. You get surplus electricity. You get into a piece how we can't really calculate exactly how much that is, but Nick Carter takes a deep dive on that, and you provide the link there. And what I'm kind of curious though about is sort of now that we've talked a lot about, you also covered non-rival energy and how that energy would otherwise be wasted, and in fact how Bitcoin doesn't waste energy, and from this vantage point, these are your words, Bitcoin appears to be a permissionless energy sink, a buyer of last resort, setting a global price floor for energy. Effectively, Bitcoin miners are a free market energy subsidy. Over the long term, this is a much more sustainable solution than the government issuing subsidies that cause unintended negative consequences, such as malinvestment and making our economy more fragile. I do wonder about the interplay between Bitcoin miners and utility systems in the sense that I think they can sort of gather proof of energy in terms of like how much can you provide a peak, and we need to get that and receive that when we ask you to shut down. But I think as Bitcoin maybe price increases, I think there'll be more agreements around you'll have to pay us more than we could sell the Bitcoin for. So your consumer would have to be willing to meet our price, I think is how I see that relationship maybe going more long-term and maybe getting maybe a touch antagonistic. If they can make a lot more money keeping their machines on for Bitcoin mining than turning over that power. And, I wonder how much authorities can enforce, you were supposed to send us 3 megawatts and we're only getting 2.5. We're the other half. Prove to us that those machines weren't on or that you weren't able to provide that electricity at that time. But what I'm kind of curious a little bit about is how after we go from pioneer species, well, what are the intermediate species, or when pioneer, like what happens there? Like what, why do we have even intermediate species, and why don't pioneer species just continue to flourish and exist in perpetuity?
Yeah, good question. Back to what you just mentioned briefly about non-rival energy and competition with energy demand on the grid. Each energy grid is essentially, at least in the United States, there's like 5 main grids, and they each have different rules and regulations. The most famous example with Bitcoin mining is ERCOT, which is Texas's grid, and it's pretty much just all Texas. And they have very open markets. It's very pro-innovation. They have a ton of wind and solar in West Texas, also a lot of oil and gas. And in that situation, your question was like, how do we know, and aren't the Bitcoin miners going to make more money if they're always mining? And the answer is yes. But they build out their contracts ahead of time. And in the contract, the Bitcoin miners actually do get paid to turn off. And they look at it on like a yearly time frame. And
but do they get paid as much as they could for their, if they sold their hash rate to the Bitcoin network? And that's price dependent. So if price is going down, they might actually make more if they have a fixed price from the grid, or they might make less if Bitcoin price is going up. And I question in those big runs, when we have a big run, will they stick to their commitment? And if they broke their commitment, what would be the repercussions to the, you know, however that plays out?
Yeah, I don't know the finer details, but my assumption is that the grid can just turn off the energy going to miners. And that's just,
I see what you're saying.
However, it's not a problem. The Bitcoin miners are very amicable to this, because let's say they're getting charged 5 cents a kilowatt hour. That's their price. Well, with this curtailment strategy, or Bitcoin miners, you have to shut off at certain times. They might give you 3 cents per kilowatt hour, but instead of having 100% uptime, you only get 90% uptime. And so in the contract, the miners get 40% lower prices on net for the year, but instead of being 100% uptime, it's only 90% uptime.
Right, right.
Yeah. And so, and that's a win-win for everybody, right? Because the Bitcoin miners want the lowest part. They want the most hashes per capital expense per year. Right. And that's okay if they miss out on a few moments, because the other moments they're reaping even more rewards to compensate. And so essentially not a problem. It works out just due to the mismatch.
Right. Everyone could kind of figure out a way to incentivize the other party. And then, I see what you're saying. That makes sense.
Yeah. Sorry. What was your other question?
Sort of about, I want to get into the part of your piece where we talk about sort of the evolution between pioneer species and then intermediate species and the displacement there.
Yeah, definitely. So from the ecology lens, right, you start with a bare rock, and then the lichen pioneer species comes in and it turns the rock into soil. And then that soil can habit some other types of organism, let's say a shrub. Then the shrub grows, and all of a sudden that creates even better ecosystem, more microbiology, and then you have a big tree. And once that big tree comes, it shades out all those original pioneer species. And so they have to leave, they die. And in the Bitcoin world, the Bitcoin miners are the pioneer species. They come, they buy all that energy. Eventually that leads to an intermediate customer, let's say a manufacturing plant, and then manufacturing plant requires employees, which leads to houses, heating, and other forms of energy demand. And at that point, the end user pays more energy costs than the Bitcoin miner does. So the Bitcoin miner is then displaced, and then they go find some other energy glut and take advantage of that excess. And so they're essentially repurposable energy, or Bitcoin mining citadel seeds, right? They plant a seed here, it grows, and they reproduce, and they go somewhere else. And so you can essentially reproduce the hardware reuse the hardware as you go, spreading prosperity.
Right. And then what is a climax community?
Yep. Climax community is like the peak ecosystem of that region. And in Bitcoin mining terms, that might be a metropolis. In ecology terms, where I live, that might be an oak forest. If you live in the tropics, it might be some other type of forest with different trees. But essentially, the as complex of an ecosystem as that region will sustain, more or less.
Right. And what's a boom town, or give us an example of a current boom town?
Yeah. So in the essay, I try to explain how this succession could work on a human level. So we touched on some of this, but energy is produced that leads to manufacturing. Manufacturing leads to humans. And I would say a boom town would be something like the gold rush, right? And in the gold rush time period, people went west in promise of riches, and you have all these people trying to mine gold, and then you have someone selling them shelter and someone selling them food and picks and shovels and denim because it's a good work, durable work pant, right? But it's not necessarily a full-on cosmopolitan city. It's really just like a, essentially like a commodity production zone with very limited services, right? That might be a boomtown. But then past the boomtown stage, we now have San Francisco, right? Which is essentially a former gold mining area. They mine gold in the mountains, you know, east of San Francisco. And it was like that for a while. And then all of a sudden there's riches here, there's energy production, there's infrastructure. And then it turns into another type of city, a climax city from a human standpoint, which now is based on technology, right? Which is, you could say is a climax community for society today, right? If you look at, okay, you can have an agricultural society, you can have an industrial society, and now we have information societies where ideas are capital. We work remotely, our money is digital, and it's really about who has the best ideas, right? That would be like the modern climax community today. And you need to have the commodities and the energy and the industry in order to even sustain an information society.
Interesting. I'm gonna read a little bit from your piece. The boomtown is now able to outcompete nearby ecosystems who have less energy and wealth. This creates a positive feedback loop leading to more jobs, more people, more abundance, and a more complex culture. Rational companies and politicians will now defend Bitcoin because it's crucial to the success of their city. Eventually, this former energy desert will become a climax community. Climax communities are human civilizations with access to large amounts of low-cost, reliable energy. They're full of cool neighborhoods, microclimates, successful corporations, apex predators, and become culturally rich with music, food and people, biodiversity. This isn't a fragile gold mining boomtown anymore. As complexity, biodiversity of the community increases, their system becomes increasingly more prosperous and anti-fragile. These climax communities will owe their success to a subtle shift in incentives created by Bitcoin's proof of work mechanism. I thought it was really interesting how you compared successful corporations to apex predators. And while I struggle, I don't go to the Bitcoin conference for the content, even though the content is fantastic. This year, I found myself actually kind of glued to the content, though, because of the way that there was less to do, I think, outside the conference, because they had the fourth day and all the culture was kind of one day. So I listened to Jordan Peterson, who I'm just not terribly familiar with, but it was really interesting how his defense of capitalism and how capitalism is really ethical. Because any long-standing business or long-term business has to act somewhat ethically with all their partners, from vendors to suppliers to consumers. They have to make these people happy. They have to provide value consistently. But then he also likened it to it. It gives an outlet for people who want to go seek and destroy, i.e. war and conquer, to do that in a positive manner, to go be an apex predator, set up a corporation that or company, whatever it is, an entrepreneurial pursuit that provides value that then brings in the energy because people want to give over their energy for the product or the service. And then that you can become your own king. And that's an okay thing, your own king or queen, and have your kingdom or your queendom, and a corporation can sustain and support that. And I think that was interesting how you likened it to apex predators, because I don't think anyone has a problem with a lion being a lion or an eagle being an eagle, but what I am curious about is what happens to the displaced pioneer species or the Bitcoin miners? I mean, obviously they don't evaporate or go away. Well, what happens to them after they've been displaced?
Yeah, after they can no longer be profitable at one energy source, what most people do is they take those machines and they find another energy source where the economics do work out. And so the win there is that they're able to be used in more than one location because you can just put them in a shipping container, move them around, replug them in, right? And so those miners have multiple purposes. We could get into the argument about how new generation miners and old generation miners, there are slightly different strategies on how to maximize them. Mm-hmm. For example, a new gen miner is really high capex. They just got manufactured. They're super efficient. per energy consumed. And so they cost a lot, right? The market wants those. And so if you have large amounts of energy, you're going to want to deploy new miners, right? However, if you have old gen miners and you know the capital expenses are extremely low, they might only have a couple of years left to run. They're not as efficient, but there's really low risk. You might only pay a couple hundred bucks per S9, for example. Well, you can plug those S9s in at a much higher energy cost and still make money as long as your equation works out. And so, yeah, you can kind of think of them as like S9s go out to pasture, right? They've already, the new gen miners are like the studs that go out and reproduce, or they're like the horses, the race horses. And then once they've already peaked, instead you bring the ponies out to just like take kids on a ride, right? You keep their productive use, but it's not quite as sexy as their first few years. Same with miners. A couple other points there to piggyback on off Jordan Peterson and capitalism being ethical. I completely agree, right? In theory, corporations must satisfy customers' wants, and customers voluntarily exchange their goods and resources for those goods and services. So it is a good trade. And the key point to that is, that's true, assuming economic reality is enforced. And it starts to get a little messy with our current version of what we call capitalism, because it's more like cronyism, right? The wealthy people, they get to bail themselves out. And it's like capitalism for all the little guys, but like corporate socialism for the big guys.
I agree.
And so that's that minor addition there.
I think he was speaking more in hypothetical absolute terms and in the defense of the greater capitalism that we would study it maybe from an academic perspective. I don't think he was arguing that we have full on capitalism here. The example I use there is during the pandemic, my local pizza place had a harder time staying in business than maybe the local Pizza Hut, because the local pizza place didn't have access to cheap loans and cheap credit to sustain themselves. And as a consumer, I lost a better product if that pizza place went out of business, because the lesser made product had better access to credit, et cetera, and was able to sustain and stay in business and eat up that market share. But I didn't get a better, hotter, bigger, tastier pizza.
Devastating.
Right. But I want to get into a few more real world examples. So maybe you could tell us what happened in Virunga. I hope I'm saying that correct, but the Democratic Republic of Congo in Africa's oldest national park.
Definitely. This actually is the case study that I originally discovered. What year is it? 2022. I think 2 years ago maybe is when I originally found this. But it's essentially a national park in the Democratic Republic of Congo called Virunga. It's kind of one of the main economic centers in a very poor country. It's because people fly there, Westerners fly there and they go on tour and whatever. They essentially monetize their natural resources through tourism. And so it's a really important region for these folks. And the tricky part is there's not a lot of energy production in that area and the locals are very poor. Right. So I think it's less than 10% of Congolese have electricity. And so for cooking food or heating their homes, they just chop down trees from the national park and they turn them into coal or they just cook them in their house. And so they're using biofuels, which is bad for the environment. And it's also really bad for kids because cooking with biofuels creates a lot of smoke and young kids' lungs cannot handle that. So there's a lot of young people dying from this indoor air pollution. And that's a huge bummer. There's also a lot of crime nearby and a lot of violence, again, due to poor conditions. There's not a lot of opportunities for young people, et cetera. Then there's this partnership with the Virunga Alliance and the European Union and some Bitcoin miners. So kind of a public private partnership kind of overseeing this natural resource. They came together and they started harnessing hydropower in the mountainous regions of Virunga. And the Bitcoin miners served as the pioneer species, essentially subsidizing the existing energy investment. And led to more net new energy assets coming online. And so it essentially made it possible for outsiders to invest in an energy asset that otherwise wouldn't have been economical because the Bitcoin miners are there from day one buying the energy, right? So it makes the energy investment more attractive. And that symbiosis between the miners and the energy assets created all kinds of amazing downstream effects for the region. Some of them would be like it promotes economic development. So now that there is access to electricity, you can manufacture things, you can heat your homes, you can spend less time doing menial tasks because you use electricity to do it instead of human labor. Right. It reduced the reliance on chopping down the trees in order to cook. So it stopped deforestation, it created jobs, tracks industry. And now that you can manufacture locally, it actually reduces reliance on imports. And countries, developing countries who did not go through an industrial revolution, they don't have enough power to build things locally. So any manufactured goods, they have to come from abroad, which is really expensive. And it minimizes quality of life. And so quality of life goes up, preserves endangered species, reduces child mortality from cooking inside, reduces violence from the systemic poverty in the region, and the list goes on. So essentially, this is an example of Bitcoin miners contributing to improving the environment, pro-economic development, literally saving children's lives, decreasing crime, the whole list, right? It's the biggest narrative violation imaginable with regards to Bitcoin mining FUD. And so honestly, when I read that story, and now many people have written about it, Gladstein has a really nice essay highlighting some of the high points there. And it took me almost 2 years to publish after I found that idea. But I'm glad I finally did get this essay out because it's such a powerful example.
Right. I want to read a little bit from it. I think it's important to highlight this. Virunga, Bitcoin miners are subsidizing existing energy hydro, which is secondary succession, and incentive development of new hydro coming online, primary succession. This symbiosis will promote economic development, help stop deforestation, create jobs, attract industry, which will reduce reliance on imports, preserve endangered species, prevent unnecessary deaths caused by cooking with biomass, and reduce violence caused by systemic poverty in the region. Energy abundance created in part due to Bitcoin miners gives hope for the future of the region. There will undoubtedly be challenges along the way, but the foundational conditions are met to encourage an undeveloped region to one day become a climax community. Next time you hear some privileged journalist claiming Bitcoin wastes energy, point them to Virunga as an example of Bitcoin providing humanitarian, economic, and environmental aid to a neglected region on a neglected continent. Two things there that I thought was interesting that you highlighted. One was that there will be undoubtedly be challenges along the way. I think that's great to note. And two, might have forgot the second one already. So I'm going to skip that. I want to highlight the other examples that you met where Bitcoin is a pioneer species around the globe. Volcano mining in El Salvador. Their profits are being used to build 20 new schools and a veterinarian hospital. I don't know how we verify that, but it sounds great. And they are mining there. So hydro mining in Laos, one of the poorest countries in the region, and an abundance of excess hydropower on the Mekong River. Laos expects to earn $190 million in 2022 from Bitcoin mining alone. Geothermal in Kenya, vast untapped geothermal is just waiting to be harnessed. Kenya lacks the capital needed to develop this energy, and Bitcoin miners can help. And hydroelectric in Ethiopia, 90% of their power comes from hydro and much of it is stranded. Bitcoin miners serve as a revenue source for utilities until infrastructure to distribute energy can catch up. Well, I'm kind of question one curveball is, so what kind of species would fiat be? Would it be a pioneer or intermediate, or, you know, what kind of species is fiat? Or, you know, have you thought about that?
I have. I wouldn't say I've thought about it in any serious depth, but the way I think about fiat is more like industrial agriculture. Fiat is like hyper engineered or hyper central planned agriculture. And so it's actually very efficient in the sense that you can just move ones and zeros on a computer and print money. You can just, you know, update a bank balance to move funds around. And in the same way that fiat agriculture or industrial agriculture is really efficient, we produce more for less because we essentially apply an industrial revolution perspective to farming. We like use big machines and chemicals and GPS, and it's pretty much all automated at this point to grow food. However, that system, although it's efficient, the system is actually very vulnerable because it's a monocrop. And if a single pest, a single predator, a single fungus comes, they can literally wipe out the entire crop. So a famous example is there was a banana in, I think it was the 50s or 60s. And this one banana was essentially it was like 80% of bananas consumed in the world were one specific banana. And they were all clones, like literally sisters, the exact same genetics all around the world. And they do that for efficiency's sake. Then an enterprising young fungus called a Fusarium learned how to consume that banana. And in about 18 months, one specific fungus ate all the bananas in the entire world, and we had a massive food shortage. And so, yes, it's efficient, but very vulnerable. Okay. And that's fiat, right? As soon as, essentially just hiding risk, getting more efficient, and just like in 08, pull one Jenga block, the whole thing collapses. That's fiat. As opposed to Bitcoin, which I consider more like an old growth forest, to keep this analogy going, where it's complex, it's biodiverse. No, it's not as efficient, but it's very, very durable, right? And I think we mentioned this earlier, but price is consistent in a fiat system, but systemically, it's risky. In a Bitcoin system, price is totally not steady. It fluctuates with the reality around it, to be fair.
Yeah.
However, you give up price stability in exchange for systemic stability, right? The old growth forest, it doesn't matter. You can have a fire there. You can introduce all the predators you want. Some organisms will die, but the complexity of that ecosystem will triumph. That's how I see it.
Yeah. I think of the world. I think of Bitcoin as reflecting the volatility of the real world. If I think about that longer, though, I think it might just reflect the volatility of fiat. And I think the world might not be. Maybe the world's a lot less volatile if we didn't have fiat, is what I'm trying to say. And so it doesn't reflect the volatility of the world, but it reflects the volatility of fiat in the world, or the way fiat creates volatility in the world. Because my day-to-day life, aside from the volatility in fiat or how fiat is represented in the exchange to Bitcoin, my day-to-day life is not very volatile. It's kind of smooth going. I mean, always good, but just kind of consistent, not very erratic. I want to recap a couple of the incentives that we've talked about as we look forward, to how human civilization can become a climax community. So you've noted we can harness energy anywhere and it can now be monetized. Existing energy assets are more economical due to symbiosis with Bitcoin miners, and cost of capital for net new energy assets has decreased. And I'm kind of curious what you think, what fraction of the world's electricity will be used to secure the money supply when we're a climax community?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think Dhruv Bansal has done the most to think about this. What does he call this? The Nakamoto? Nakamoto point. Yeah, I'm trying to find it on my article there. There we go. The Nakamoto point, which is the marginal revenue from proof of work is equal to the marginal revenue from selling energy to the grid. So essentially, we're going to mine Bitcoin up until the point where it's not profitable anymore. So these miners are going to spread out all around the world and mine every single electron with every single electron we produce, unless it's more profitable for the grid to sell that energy to a consumer. And then if you say, well, what percentage is that on a whole planet-wide or species-wide scale? It really depends on how efficient we are with energy and what we do with it. But I think the answer is a lot. And that's not a bad thing, right? Because the energy can't be stored very well into the future. So we might as well do something productive with it. And now the other side of this whole thing, which we haven't touched on, is that Bitcoin mining is not wasting energy. It pays for it. It competes in the free market to buy it. And that energy is going to good use. Although the New York Times reporters might not acknowledge the fact that Bitcoin provides benefits, hundreds of millions of people around the world buy it, own it, and rely on it. And so by that alone, the energy is worth it because someone's willing to pay for it. And then you might say, well, Bitcoin, we could do what Bitcoin does and use less energy on net, but that also is wrong. There is no replacement for proof of work. And that real world energy cost is what enables us to remove the printing press from political power centers. Okay, you cannot separate money from state without proof of work. It is impossible. And so the answer is no, there is no substitute that could use less energy and provide the same benefits. Although that's very hard to understand, I'm optimistic because the conversation's happening and the Bitcoiners are understanding this deeper. And as they interface with the greater world, slowly people will realize the magic of proof of work.
Yeah, I agree. And I want to read another piece from your work. As our energy constraints decline, new technologies will become economical, such as desalination plants, removing CO2 from the atmosphere, producing green hydrogen, molecular weight refineries, space travel, and terraforming Mars. On a micro scale, anything that uses heat as a resource can be made more economical through symbiosis with Bitcoin mining. For example, individuals can heat their home or greenhouse with the waste heat from their ASIC rigs. More importantly, however, their energy mastery will do more for humanitarian causes than all the NGOs combined. And I think this sort of buttresses up with the main point of more energy is better, even though the mainstream narrative seems to be less energy is better. And that, you know, mastering energy will raise the minimum standard of living globally, what it could do. But we seem to be, you know, sort of, I think this is where we turn to like what I frame up as the fourth turning, or where we are today. we've talked about the fourth turning before. You've talked about it where, you know, it's a lens. It's a way of looking at things. It's not a script, right? So, you know, we have these two divergent forces in my mind. You sum it up as the great spreading out, which is sort of the pioneer species, Bitcoin miners. But I also think it's like sort of people who are voting with their feet or leaving the relic of the cities and sort of the industrial age more towards the informational age. But against that is the mega cities and sort of the vision of China and the World Economic Forum and centrally planned mega cities. And where do you think we are in all of this? Maybe almost a year and a half has passed since we talked. So I think when we talked, I thought of it as maybe, you know, we're in the fourth turning and that would sort of peak around 2025 in terms of conflict and dynamics sort of. But now I feel like I think that's all pushed off a bit. I don't think there's going to be a peak as soon as I thought. I think we've, you know, in terms of the 28 and what we just went through in the last 2 or 3 years, maybe we're through it. Maybe they can punt for another 10 or 12 years on inflation, money printing, revolution, things of this nature, 80-year cycles. You know, when you think of a pendulum, you know, I think a pendulum usually is not a free-flowing thing. There's usually someone holding the pendulum from time to time. And sometimes they can hold it longer on one end before they let it swing back. So I'm kind of curious where you think we are. And one thing I've heard you say is, you know, young people need hope. So I'm kind of curious, maybe where do you see hope now? And where do you see us in this pendulum swing?
Yeah, definitely. So I'll start with the humanitarian side of energy mastery. And I'm making a pretty flagrant point here, which is that all the NGOs who claim to do good in the world are going to be dwarfed simply by Bitcoin mining existing and the downstream effects there. And I actually do believe this, and I think it will be true probably in the next 20 years, maybe less. And Lynn Alden, actually, I was tweeting about, hey, what do we do when we have more energy? Because one of the consequences, I think, of Bitcoin mining is we're going to master energy, meaning we're going to be able to produce way more distributed at a lower cost, more efficient, et cetera. And more energy opens a lot of doors. And one of those doors is we'll be able to raise the standard of living globally of the developing countries up to the same standard as the developed world. And the number one way to do this is to lower their cost of energy. And so I think that's something that a lot of people miss, is it is the most humanitarian thing you can do is give people more energy. And to tie it back to your previous comment about Jordan Peterson, he also made a comment recently where he said the most, if you want to act morally, the number one thing you should do is make everyone rich, because that will decrease all the petty things in life that humans shouldn't die for, reduce all the suffering that's easy to reduce, et cetera. And one giant way to make everyone quote unquote rich, as he says, is to give them more energy. And that actually empowers people to become rich themselves. We don't want to hand them wealth. We want to allow them to create wealth more easily. And energy is sort of a limiting factor for those developing countries. And then you can look at the New York Times or the Coastal Elites, the MacBook wielding, $5 latte drinking, energy keyboard warriors who chastise developing countries like India. And they say, India, you are not allowed to use fossil fuels, even though America uses fossil fuels. That's why we develop. That's why we have such a high quality of life. And we have the gall to tell developing countries that they may not do the same when they can barely feed their population. Somehow the hypocrisy doesn't land here. They're totally unaware of their hypocrisy, which is nonsense. But the reality is they deserve to industrialize just like we did. And it's our duty to help them do so. And if we have an opinion like don't do it with so much carbon, fine, help them build nuclear, right. Help them build natural gas, et cetera. But there is no moral grounds to prevent them from doing so. That's one point. Another point with these boom towns or these, as countries start to develop with energy, what we're going to see, and a point I forgot earlier, is that the countries with more energy are going to outcompete the countries that have less energy. And more energy means your goods are cheaper, you have more jobs, mm-hmm. you can export mm-hmm. things, you can build things, and that attracts more intellectual capital due to the higher quality of life, et cetera. And so that's the other side of this equation, is it starts off a positive feedback loop, and the whole world is in a global competition, and more now than ever, right? Another prediction I made in this essay is we're going to spread out more as a population. And I think there's going to be essentially two paths. There's going to be the mega city, like you mentioned, which will be where most people live on a percentage basis. Mm. They're going to live in the shipping containers. They're going to eat the bugs. They're going to own nothing and be happy. Everything is going to be surveilled. It's going to be a social credit scoring system. And I think a lot of people opt for this. Most people won't have to work that much. It will be some sort of weird techno egalitarian thing. However, it's sort of like becoming a sheep at the farm and being like, well, I guess we're all sheep. So everyone has the same amount and that's okay. And we just walk around eating grass. And for the people who choose that, more power to you. I don't have that ability to be tamed. It's just not in my constitution. And so I will certainly be rejecting that concept. And that brings us to the other side, which is that the ability to, the incentive that Bitcoin provides to produce energy anywhere is going to lead to humans being able to leave the existing population centers and go to the energy source. Okay, so rather than build cities around jobs, right, we all work remotely, rather than building cities next to rivers, which is transportation and energy, we can go build that next to a new energy source, right? So it sort of allows us to colonize new territory. And then you combine that with all things in the sovereign individual thesis and or just the information age, right? Our money's digital, we work remotely, so geography is less important. You combine all these trends, and that's kind of where I see this going. And if we zoom way, 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 way back in human civilization, in the beginning, the emergence of the nation state. Nation states emerged where agriculture was possible. Why is that? Because the state can essentially trap citizens next to their farms. They can account for how much grain they're growing so they know how much to tax them. And it's essentially like you're locked in and it's really cheap for the state to extract taxes. However, the barbarians on the periphery, the people who live in the foothills, the wetlands, the forest, rocky terrain, the animal pastoralists, et cetera, these people are really expensive to tame because you can't account for their grain. You can't come and take their grain if they misbehave. So they're too expensive to civilize. And I don't want to call the Bitcoiners the barbarians because our friends at the New York Times will eat that up. But it is, so I sort of see a parallel there where, yes, you can go live to the mega city and you're being farmed, or we can live on the periphery of society, build strong families, good values, and preserve free markets, preserve liberalism in its purest sense. And I think that's sort of what this next stage of life is going to be, now bringing it to the fourth turning, is I see the big fight being between individualism and collectivism, between classical liberal values and this new upgraded techno state, this all-seeing, all-powerful digital panopticon, central bank-run, social credit scoring type thing, similar to what China's doing, right? It's essentially saying AI software and surveillance can sort of replace the functions of a state, and you can sort of steer the population through technology, which is sort of a mix between Brave New World and 1984. And, you know, if I'm a central planner type, my mouth is salivating at this opportunity because it produces tremendous power to the power structures. However, as someone who wants freedom because my political persuasion leads me there, but also someone who's more practical about the world, I don't think you can create innovation in a top-down, centrally planned society. And I think the data supports that. And so I think it's more important that we have free and open societies, which produce innovation, and innovation is what produces prosperity. Okay. Central planning does not produce innovation, which means it does not produce prosperity. It can be efficient, but it doesn't generate novelty. It doesn't inspire humans to create. It doesn't maximize the human capital on the planet. It actually diminishes our potential as individuals to create wealth. And I think what most people miss here in the central planning class is that order emerges naturally from individuals acting in their own best interest. We want to contribute. We want to benefit our lot in life. And by doing so, it creates wealth for everyone else. And so that's the world I want to live in. That's the world that I see being enabled by these remote city states, these startup cities based on remote, you know, Gen 4 nuclear reactors or something like that. I foresee Bitcoiners ideologically swooping in over this next decade, buying distressed land from distressed countries, building special economic zones, attracting individuals with similar values, similar to how Singapore or Hong Kong was founded or Dubai, right? We have the model and, you know, sort of reinvent governance with new ideas. And I think this is important, not because I think that that's necessarily the right way to organize, but because we need innovation and experiments in governance, right? We need to embrace the information age, and that requires experimenting with new forms of governance. So I'd like to see 1,000 citadels, if you will, around the world with all different models being tested, and we'll figure out what works. And maybe we go from 300 nations to 3,000 nations. And I believe that smaller nations are better because you can more accurately reflect the population's will. Whereas in the United States, the people who live in Montana and the people who live in Los Angeles have almost nothing in common. Right. But yet we have many of the same laws. And I think the U.S. did a pretty good job with federalism. The states make their own rules and the federal government does the least amount necessary. However, our founding fathers' ideals have changed. And now the central government has way too much power. And I think that comes at a really high cost. And I'm optimistic about this next stage. Young people need hope. Bitcoin is the sense of hope. And if we preserve the spark of freedom through this sort of great spreading out, I think the long-term prospects are going to be really good. We're going to go through a weird transition period. And then on the other side, we're going to merge in this more distributed, more rich civilization that's more durable, more long-lasting, and significantly wealthier per capita, and significantly more in tune with our environment. I think we can win both here if we do this next stage right. But the stakes are high, to be fair. They're very high.
Yeah, I mean, the stakes are high, but what I'm hearing, what I'm gleaming is that I think there's going to be the opportunities to opt out, but I don't think there's going to be opportunity. What I mean by that is people can opt out into Bitcoin, into sovereignty, into leaving the mega city, but there won't be, but opting in will be the majority, will be the mainstream that. And then that is still headed very much so towards mega cities, social credit scores, that in the scenario that we just talked about, Bitcoin is not destroying that. It's living aside it. And you could kind of like move into the Bitcoin overlay. But for the next 8 to 10 years, I think what I'm gathering is everything's going to stay more or less the same unless you opt into the Bitcoin overlay. But for at least another 8 to 10 more years, it's not going to be like you opt into the Bitcoin overlay and you exit completely, because so much of your life is still going to be wrapped up in this other 90% of humanity that's not in the Bitcoin overlay. And it seems like to me that the collectivism will increase there. The social credit scoring system will increase there. And there just might not be a pendulum swing out of that for the people that are harnessed or in that mousetrap. And whereas I was hoping more of the optimistic version is that like Bitcoin sort of eradicates or makes these systems crumble because it exists rather than lives alongside. And I think both are fine. It's great that it lives alongside. It's great that you can go into it right now. And I was also thinking with this fourth turning that we would see some sort of climactic change, which I'm starting to think that the way they've handled the last 3 years, that they're going to be able to avoid a climactic change for at least another 10 years, maybe. And who knows, maybe they can kick it then another 10 years. Do you know what I'm getting at in terms of?
Yeah. Lots to chew on here. So yes, I think in the short term, it will be an opting out process. It will be, I don't want to participate in the Great Reset. I'm going to go raise a family in the foothills. And I view that more as a temporary thing. And you said like, we'll still have to interact with normie land. And I think the answer is yes, but increasingly less. We can grow food locally. We can work online. We don't need to go to cities ever. There's no need. There's no actual need. We may want to. And I think the analogy,
well, culturally, like, cities tend to provide something these days. Yeah. I mean, in terms of theater, or I'm not talking about like, Spider-Man, but live theater or things that are still very localized. The record player changed that. You know, every restaurant used to have a piano player, so you could have 100,000 piano players in America, and then all of a sudden you have the record, and now it's like you have the piano player for Beyonce, and Beyonce is the only artist. You know what I mean? Like, you get that sort of
yeah, I agree. There will be a demand for cultures that cities do well, for sure. And I view that as like, we'll live in our city states, our citadels, and when we want to go experience the theater or whatever culture, it'll be like going into the Matrix. Right. We'll put on our normie clothes. We'll put on our anti-facial recognition hats. We'll put in our contacts, disguise our identity, our GPS jammers, you know, whatever cypherpunk technology we have to sort of enter without being seized or spied on or whatever. And yeah, we'll plug in, we'll go to the Matrix, and we'll come out back to normal life. That's kind of how I see that. And kind of a fun way to look at it. But if we look a little bit longer term, what's going to happen, in my view, is that the productive people are not going to want to go to the megacities. They're going to move their capital. They're going to move their businesses. They're going to move their wealth, their resources to the more free places. And what's going to happen then is those city states are going to start to outcompete. And honestly, if we go into that mega state world, the average person there will be net negative for productivity. They're going to consume more than they produce. They're just going to be cattle to the mega state. Whereas in the city states, there will be more self-reliance. The average person will be a net producer. And so the quality of life will be a lot richer. There will be upward mobility there. It's going to attract the type of people who want to produce. And over time, I predict those city states in aggregate starting to outcompete the mega states. But how long does that take? I have no idea. If I put out a number, I would just be making it up. But I definitely see that being a more effective model going forward, right? The Industrial Revolution model, which is what we're sort of starting to leave now, was a model of the biggest state with the biggest army and the most Navy and the most GDP. They win due to economies of scale. However, economies of scale are now starting to unwind as we enter the information age. You actually don't want as much infrastructure because ideas are capital. Like, you need a base level of commodities and manufacturing, yes, but the real wealth is in ideas. And in that type of society, we want to optimize for smaller nation states that are more nimble. And yes, epic trade networks, et cetera. But yeah, my long-term view is it will be an out-competing process, similar to capitalism out-competing communism, similar to industrial nations out-competing pre-industrial nations, or the Navy, the nation with the best ships own the seas, and they own the seas, they own the trade, and they own the world, right? It's just another step evolution, and the better system will out-compete. With regards to fourth turning and climaxes, you made a point, like, essentially that they can kick the can down the road on inflation. I think that's true. I think what's like, we're going to have more inflation, but I also see a situation where we destroy demand, financial markets melt down, and there's actually everyone feels poor, and then demand is entirely destroyed. So actually, like, an inflationary pulse and then a deflationary pulse. And that deflationary pulse would benefit the people with all the money. They'll essentially be buying all the assets cheap that all the normies had to capitulate on to pay for their own food. So that's honestly the worst case scenario. But in order to destroy demand, you might say that a climactic event like a war, which we're, I guess, in the middle of now, that's actually good for destroying demand. So if you wanted to destroy demand and get inflation under control and reset the game towards the elites, you actually do want that climactic event. So contrary to popular belief, the climax in fourth turnings is not necessarily a bad thing,
right?
Depending on which way you look at it.
What is your take on inflation and gaslighting right now?
I view it so, so offensively that, I mean, all of our leaders are unserious. They talk to us like we're unintelligent. They blatantly lie. They, you know, gaslighting, as you would say. And I just find it offensive. They're clearly not sending their best. Our institutions are hollowed out. They're bought and paid for. They're recruiting the wrong types of people. They're producing poor outcomes. There's no accountability. And it leads to lack of trust, right? That's why we see populism rising everywhere in the world. The system's not working for most people, so they revolt. And if we go into a situation here where we're going to have food shortages, which appears to be almost 100% true, it will be uneven, right? The U.S. will be mostly fine. Food importer countries like Egypt will probably be wrecked. And when people can't afford food, they burn the cities down, right? And it feels like we're heading into that type of a future where we screwed it up so bad that we're going to have nasty, nasty famines. The gaslight around inflation, they're going to gaslight around food shortages, they're going to gaslight on everything. And so, again, I just feel like it's time to cleanse the institutions. That's what fourth turnings are for. We burn the dead wood and we allow new things to grow. And so I think we're still on the, it's ramping up, right? Like, I've been talking about the fourth turning for a few years now, and It's definitely getting closer to the climate or the climax, but I think we still have a long ways to go. We definitely haven't reached the climax, but it feels closer and closer. But again, timelines are tough. Two years, 5 years, 10 years.
It's starting to feel anticlimactic to me, but we are still, you know, I mean, it's a lens. It's not a map. Maybe we're early in the process. I could pick your brain forever for hours, but one last question. So let's go on a really long time scale here. Because I, you know, when I bring up the word civil war, I'm not talking about like in 2024, we're going to fight over who's president, you know, but more like over 100, 200, 500 years. Is America as 50 states going to last? And what does that mean? Is war the end of the states? Is it a dissolution? Is it a petering out? Like, how does that look to you over like hundreds of years? Because we mentioned before, Al, like, I think we both really agree here is like smaller nation states would be better, citadel states, whatever you want to call it. So what's your outlook on the United States of America?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. Not something that I've put too much thought in, but I would say on a 500 year time scale, I would be shocked if what we call America today exists. I would put that at probably a 90% confidence that it will not be the same. In a 100 year time frame, that using the fourth turning lens, that means we'd go through two additional fourth turnings. So the one we're in now plus one more. That seems to me to believe that it'd be pretty hard to survive another two. But you know, I don't have any confidence on the 100 years. But when I think about long term, I think about these mega political forces, like in the sovereign individual. And I could see the U.S. breaking into regional micro states. I could see a new constitution, a new form of federalism where we maintain borders and we have other centralized systems. But generally speaking, the states regain more power than the Fed. I could see that happening. I could also see the U.S. making it through this next stage, riding into the Bitcoin future in response to the centralized East model and allowing America to sort of double down on our founding fathers' principles of decentralization, federalism, individual property rights, entrepreneurship, et cetera. I think America has the ability to make that decision. And you know, you see a lot of Bitcoiners talking about how Bitcoin is American values and how if we choose that route, it might actually be the best way to prevent a future where China's in control. And I think what we're going to enter here is also a giant space race. China has a moon rover that's active right now. The US does not. And so I think the next fight is going to be colonizing the moon. There's only like three good areas for a moon base. A moon base gives us manufacturing off planet. It allows us to build things and supply to Mars. It allows us communication, weapons, all kinds of things. And China's ahead of us right now. And so I think in a future world that I want to live in, I want to raise my kids in, the US model of governance of free and open societies based on trade and liberal values, I would prefer our solar system to be colonized under that flag. Mm-hmm. Rather than a Chinese authoritarian flag. And so, yeah, the solar system's next, or the inner planets are next. I would like Bitcoin to be involved. And I think a big part of us, or sorry, I would love American values to be involved. And I think Bitcoin helps us here by empowering Western liberal values, because that's what Bitcoin wants. Bitcoin's bias is for the individual, where China's the opposite. And so, yeah, I think that the rising Chinese dragon or tiger or whatever analogy is coming. And without Bitcoin, I think the US loses this fight. With Bitcoin, I think we win this fight very, very handedly.
Yeah, I think it's kind of like the same way if you looked at the fight, you wouldn't phrase it this way, but turning to gold. So, you know, the US and the Western states turn to gold faster and sooner than India and China. And I think it cost them a lot in terms of generational wealth over hundreds of years. And I think the same thing will play out with Bitcoin. Whoever turns to it first and hardest and longest and strongest will win that race. And you'll see the other things like, oh, the race to the moon was won by whoever turned to Bitcoin first. you know, the race to the Mars will be won by whoever turned to Bitcoin first. The same way gold kind of predicated some of those victories, maybe, or at least maybe the way I'm linking it up. And, you know, because I don't like flags, but I do like ideas and values. And I think the American flag represents those. But so, you know, I said one last question, but I forgot to mention it was 27 parts. But no, one follow up, though, is do you think corporations will usurp nation states in terms of maybe like, yeah, politically elected bodies versus sort of like capital, like apex predators?
Definitely. I foresee, let's say, the top 5 to 10 nation states being the most powerful forces. That could be like an EU, a UN, a NAFTA, a US, a Russia, China, Brazil, India, whatever. And then I also see like the long tail of cities or nations, sorry, are going to be way at the bottom. And I think they're going to, their currencies are going to break. They're either going to dollarize or Bitcoinize. And then I think like, let's say power structures 10 through 30, right? After the largest nation states will come the corporations. And the largest corporations will be way powerful than the media nation state. Right. They probably already are. And I think that will probably continue. Yeah. Seems obvious to me.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how it all plays out, you know, one day at a time. I think fortunately with Bitcoin, you can kind of take all the volatility and all this and just express it and experience it all through price. And then so it's like a subtraction mechanism. It removes it from your life. And you can focus on maybe the real volatility in your life, your day-to-day life. It's sort of that, I think of that as that that risk off asset and a way to store your time and value in something that brings less risk. And I think the lens of ecology is really fascinating. And I love your take on things. So I'll definitely leave the floor to you for, you know, any parting words and let people know where they could find you and your work.
Awesome. Yeah, I really appreciate it, Ted. Super fun conversation. To find me, Twitter is the best, BQUITTEM, B, then my last name. And my writing is on my personal website, brandonquittum.com. You can read essays there. And if any of this resonated with you, send me a DM on Twitter. They are still open. I love hearing from you guys. And yeah, I mean, that's pretty much it. Go plant some Citadel seeds.
We'll roll out to your words. In harmony with nature, the world is a complex place, and lately it feels like things are going off the rails. The central planners underestimate the complexity of the world and make poor decisions in haste. This results in unintended negative consequences affecting everyone. As they say, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Good intentions aren't good enough. Results are all that matter. If we hope to improve the complex system we call society, we need to carefully fix the incentives. Through ecology, we can see Bitcoin as a subtle disturbance that changes the incentives around two foundational systems in society, money and energy. This results in digital sound money and mastery over energy. Together, these will serve as pillars of progress in the 21st century. Now go forth and plant Citadel seeds all around the universe. In quotes, large streams from little fountains flow, tall oaks from little acorns grow. Plant seeds, not weeds. Bitcoin fixes this. Thanks so much, Brandon. It has been so enjoyable.
Thanks, Ed. Appreciate it, man.
Thanks, man. Peace.